The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. On this week's show...
If the police imagine that a crowd is full of potentially violent, roguish elements, then they're going to react in a fairly robust, possibly violent way towards them. But if there's some communication between the two groups, then it's a completely different scenario.
Science writer Michael Bond discusses the power of others, why we are hardwired for groupthink, and why the supposed madness of crowds is more complicated than we all think. And we'll be casting our eye across some of the big science news stories last week, including gravitational waves, now you see them, now you don't, why light and mouse brains give us an insight into laying down memories, and the future of medicine and health is in your pocket, or bag, well, close to your person. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Joining me in the studio this week is Nicola Davis, commissioning editor on Observer Tech Monthly, and from Nature magazine, Ewan Calloway. Welcome to you both, and welcome back, Ewan.
Thank you. Good to be here.
First up, we turn to a huge discovery that now looks on uncertain ground. Nicola, Ewan, guess what I'm talking about?
Stab in the dark, gravitational waves.
You're very good. So this is a story that in March really went around the world, and it caused enormous excitement in the scientific community, which was... a group based out of Harvard, but with other scientists elsewhere, who used a telescope called Bicep 2 down at the South Pole to say that they had seen the first evidence of primordial gravitational waves, these ripples in space which imprint themselves on what's called the cosmic microwave background, which itself is the radiation left over from the first light of the Big Bang. And what they thought they had seen and what they claimed to have seen is a kind of swirl pattern that you get in the polarization of the light, so the direction in which the light waves oscillate. And this particular twist in the light that you can pick up is supposedly indicative. I mean, they use the word smoking gun, but indicative of what's called inflation theory, which is this massive, rapid expansion of the universe in the very earliest moments after the Big Bang, or during the Big Bang, really. So that announcement in March was met with huge fanfare, but straight afterwards and since then on the physics blogs, there's been a lot of concern coming out with people saying, well, have they taken in everything else into consideration? Could this be some strange effect that they've been seeing that is actually due to something else? And it's kind of come to a head, I would say, because a couple of studies have come out which really do pour quite a lot of cold water on the discovery. I mean, one of the main ones being from a group at Princeton who have said that the team didn't seem to have adequately taken account of dust in the galaxy, which can produce the same effect. Now, the funny thing about dust in the galaxy is that it's not all spherical particles. You get some which are elongated, and when they're elongated, they polarize light. And they polarize light in all different types of directions. But if you're looking for a particular type of twist, you'll find it as you'll find other types of twists in it. And something that happened in the analysis of the Harvard group seems to suggest they didn't take into account the effects of the dust properly. And the Princeton team, a guy called David Spergel is one of the authors, reckons that the entirety of their signal could be down to dust.
So one of the questions I have is how did the Harvard team come to overlook this dust? Was it they didn't think about it at all? Was it that they just looked at, misestimated it? How did that happen?
Dust in the galaxy is what is called, they call it foreground. So they're saying, what are the effects in the foreground? When you're looking out to space, what they're trying to do is pick up polarizations in light from way back in the universe. And the foreground issues are, okay, what is the stuff in between there that might give you the same kind of signal and screw up your results? Now, there isn't much data out there on what those effects could be. But the data they managed to get hold of was from a slide that the arrival team, the European Space Agency's Planck team, had put out at a conference. So this was a PowerPoint slide that showed how much dust can polarize light when you look out with the Planck telescope. Now, what they did, they digitized the slide and then used that. So what they did, they took a snapshot of the slide and then processed the graph on the slide to work out how much of the effect dust has, to then put into their own calculations. What they failed to realize was that the graph wasn't showing the effect of dust in the immediate sort of vicinity in our own galaxy. It was an average of all of the effects of dust going all the way back. And dust from further out polarizes light less. So the effect it has when you average is to make, if you think you're only looking at nearby dust, it makes that signal look a lot small. So it made them underestimate the effect of dust in the galaxy. So when they then put that into their models, they say, well, actually, this is how much twisting you'd expect from dust. And this is how much we see. And they saw a lot more. So they said this must be from gravitational waves. Mm. But what they'd done is they actually misinterpreted the data they'd taken, they'd grabbed hold of. And it may be that they've still seen something. I mean, some scientists are still optimistic that they've got a signal. It isn't trashed. But the researcher who did the analysis at Princeton told me categorically that he thinks they should withdraw the claim that they've seen gravitational waves. Now, the team themselves have said they're not going to do that.
Is there anything that can... Oh, sorry to butt in. Is there anything that can settle this? I mean, what I heard was that the critics are saying there's no evidence for or against gravitational waves. What do we need to settle this?
What you need is just more data, as ever. I mean, they need BICEP 2, this telescope, to come up with more data. They need essentially an independent group, and that will be the Planck research team is going to come out with some data on this in the next 2 or 3 weeks. So still within June, we should have Planck's take on what's happened here, or at least enough concrete data that will allow other people to sort that out. And in one sense, you can say this is just science in action. This is how science works. But on the other hand, I think it's unusual because the claims they made when they did the press conference, and let's remember that they gave the press conference without having a peer-reviewed paper, the claims they made there were incredibly strong. I mean, they said, you know, in their press release at least, this is the first direct image of gravitational waves in the primordial sky. They said the results are not only a smoking gun for inflation, they also tell us when inflation took place and how powerful the process was. And actually, neither of those things are on very solid ground.
Doesn't this show another slightly concerning aspect, which is that they came across this PowerPoint slide from the ESA, you said? Wouldn't it have been, in the normal way of science, they should have contacted the ESA and discussed the impact of dust with them rather than just use secondhand a PowerPoint slide that they perhaps weren't aware of the context of? Is that not showing sort of, you know, perhaps that they want, you know, is it not a danger that people are trying to push ahead with science, you know, without really discussing it in the international way we all imagine science is done now?
I think it reflects how competitive this is. And you could say, I mean, scientists have said to me that they think Harvard, meaning that entire team, were aggressive, was the word used to me, in how they went out and interpreted this. I don't think people are saying their results don't stand. I think what they're saying is the interpretation, which is kind of what people remember, the claim, was a claim too far. And, you know, Planck could have said, look, that's the data we've got, and we haven't finalized it. It was a conference proceeding, and it's work in progress. We'll let you have it when we're done. And so they say, if they say we're going to use it anyway. I mean, I don't know exactly what went on that level, but the bottom line is they didn't have the proper data. They didn't have the proper interpretation of that data.
But if everyone sat around waiting until they had 100% confirmation of their ideas, nothing would ever be published. Nothing would ever get out there. So couldn't you just say, as you said earlier, couldn't you just say that this is how science is done? This is science working, right?
Well, I think my opinion on it is, and what does that matter? But I mean, I think you wouldn't have seen this happen from like CERN. I'm absolutely sure it wouldn't have happened because those guys would have had, and let's face it, they had a press conference and a seminar before having a published paper when they announced the Higgs. But they have an enormous internal review process that is high quality and huge. But they also will caveat things. In the lead up, when they first saw signals of the Higgs, they didn't say we found the Higgs. They said, well, we've seen something that looks like it, but it could be there, it could be not. We can't say anything yet. And I think it's the certainty of the claims that is most questionable over this. It's not that I think maybe if they had just published a paper and they'd had a press conference saying, we think we might have seen gravitational waves, rather than saying, we've seen them, and that this is, you know, a world-changing era and videoed, you know, someone telling the news to a guy who came up with the inflation theory and breaking out champagne and making it very much a discovery announcement. I think that's where they've screwed up, frankly.
That's the thing, because there's nothing necessarily wrong with the data that they've got. It's their interpretation of that data that is where the problem is.
And how that data was communicated and hyped over the inflation theory. You know?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So there you go. That's science. Now we turn to one of the most interesting new techniques being used by neuroscientists. It's called optogenetics. Ewan, you wrote about new research that gives us much more clarity about how we write, erase, and rewrite memories. Tell us more about this one.
Right. I'm going to talk about a paper that was published in the journal Nature, where I work, last week from a team at San Diego. And they basically have done exactly that. They've used light to write and erase memories in the brains of rats, which is kind of cool in an inception sort of way, but it actually shows us something really fundamental about how memories are made, what the physical basis for memories are. So what these researchers did was they took rats and they did kind of a traditional conditioning experiment where you get rats to fear a tone by playing a tone and then zapping them. And so if you play that tone again, the rats will kind of freeze up in anticipation of a zap, even if a zap isn't coming. And so they use this technique called optogenetics you just described, which basically you insert a gene into some brain cells that makes those brain cells sensitive to light. And so they were able to instill a fear of a tone that the rats had never heard with light. So they just shine some light into the rat's brain, and they would freeze up as if they had heard a sound. They implanted a memory that never existed with light. That's pretty cool. The really cool thing is that then they used light to erase that memory, and so they could simulate the sound again, and they wouldn't freeze, and then they could use light again to bring it back. So they're basically playing memory like a yo-yo, is what the researcher Roberto Malino told me, which is really quite a cool thing to do, to be able to write, erase, and rewrite and erase a memory with flashes of light in the brain of a rat.
Is it really a memory, though? I mean, can you say that what they're doing is in the brain constitutes a memory, or could it be that you're now just instilling that reaction in a mouse and then turning it off again?
It's a good question. I mean, it might be better called a fearful association. The area of the brain that they were kind of activating is an area involved in processing emotion and an area involved in processing sound. So it's not areas of the brain that we think of more complicated memories, such as, you know, what an oatmeal biscuit smells like. Memories like that, you know, are encoded in other parts of the brain. But I think I'd see it as a basic form of memory. And the research was done in the context of this molecular process called long-term potentiation, which is something that was discovered in the 1960s and 70s, in part by Tim Bliss, who's a researcher at the National Institute for Medical Research here. And it was long thought to be the physical basis for memory. And what long-term potentiation does is it basically makes communication between two neurons more efficient. And so it was long theorized that this could be the physical basis for a memory, because you basically, I mean, you've got billions and, well, trillions and trillions of brain cells. So how do you create something so complex as a memory that stays around for a long time by basically creating this kind of privileged path of communication between neurons? And so basically 4 decades of research have supported this idea that this process is the basis for memory. And only by activating it and turning it off with light have these researchers conclusively demonstrated, for at least this kind of memory, that this is probably the physical basis of it. Yes.
So you were saying about how we create these memories by having sort of strengthened synapses. So what does that actually mean? What do you mean by strengthening a synapse? What's the actual physical thing that's underlying that?
Yeah, it happens in a number of different ways, but in one classical way that occurs, you get basically, if neurons fire together repeatedly, you get physical changes at the synapses of these two neurons. There's a model that says the neurons that fire together wire together, and that's kind of how LTP has been explained.
But how would you then erase a memory? What happens then?
That's a really good question. There's a corollary process called long-term depression that's also important in weakening connection between synapses. And I I wouldn't say that this is universal, but I think in some cases it might be just due to the opposite, that you're making communication less efficient between these two neurons, for instance, by reducing the number of neurotransmitter receptors on one end. But there, I think it's a complicated process, and there are lots of molecular ways of achieving it. But this research, people told me, pretty conclusively establishes that, at least for some kinds of memories, that this is what maintains it, which is pretty neat.
And is there any plans in the future to use this to sort of treat people with traumatic memories? Or, you know, is this an area that people are looking into?
I don't think people are looking at physically playing with memory in this way in human brains. But this provides, you know, a really interesting, I mean, it shows you, starts to show you what the physical basis is of a memory is. And so maybe you could manipulate it. And, I mean, people are interested in, there are some memories that do us no good. You know, for instance, people with post-traumatic stress syndrome who come back from war and just, you know, they have these memories that haunt them. And people are interested in understanding the molecular basis of memory so they can help people with these disorders. Maybe you won't be erasing it with light, but maybe it'll be drugs that kind of simulate it.
To read Ewan's writing on this research, go to nature.com, and we'll have a link on the blog for this podcast. But do also check out The Guardian's Mo Costandi's article on this as well. That's on the Neurophilosophy blog. Nicola, the Observer Discover section had a piece on the Internet of Things yesterday. Take us through that.
Well, this is a great piece by Luke Dormer, who was talking about how all of the objects in our house are set to be sort of wired up so that we can harness and explore data from all sorts of different devices around our home. So this is ranging from the thermostat. So you might have heard of the Nest thermostat, which, you know, learns your settings in your house and automatically adjusts, right through to Bluetooth toothbrushes that can track your brushing style and make sure that you've really got into all the different nooks and crannies, right through to kitchen scales, which you can set to weigh your different pieces of food, and then it can tell you the nutritional content of your meal, and so on and so forth. So this is really about gaining data from all different aspects of daily life. But it's not just about harnessing data, it's also about giving you useful feedback. So one of the other examples which is coming up is, for example, an Internet of Things enabled toilet. So, for example, you can go to the loo and your toilet will look at your urine and perhaps even your poo and be able to pick out whether, for example, you might have traces which would be markers of diabetes, or perhaps could tell women if they're pregnant, or, you know, even check for other diseases and problems. So this is all part of this trend towards trying to make our homes and our lives, in quotes, intelligent.
I'm not a Luddite at all, but I'm sure that there will be enormously useful things coming from this. But there are a couple of things that worry me. One is that I suspect this means that Apple will be irretrievably woven into my life, that my house lights will get a virus at some point, that when I go to the toilet one way or another, data on what I've got is going to be on some server somewhere, that people are going to be then flashing up on my toilet mirror some treatment for some issue I've got. It's like, it's going to be relentless, isn't
it? There is a worry, of course, that anything like this could be misused, could be hacked, there could be privacy problems.
But actually, you're going to now just dismiss it and brush it away and say, but
not.
We'll be able to go online when we're walking between the bedroom and the toilet. Hooray!
One of the interesting things in Luke's article is that he talks about a recent survey that suggested that 70% of people have said that they'd be willing to share data from their lavatory if it could lead to healthcare savings. So it's sort of all a question of, you know, what you're prepared to put up with, if you think the output is worth the input. But, you know, there are problems. And of course, one of the areas where this could become more problematic, perhaps, is, for example, in the area of connected cars. So this is where you have all sorts of aspects of your car hooked up to the Internet of Things. So this could be as simple as, you know, CarPlay, which is Apple's attempt to sort of integrate your iPhone into your car so you can play music and text and stuff all while you're driving. So it's all integrated. So that's one area. But of course, you know, the more of that sort of thing you integrate into these different systems, the more dangers obviously crop up. And you wouldn't want somebody hacking your car. You certainly wouldn't want somebody hacking your toilets.
But all those opportunities are going to be there, aren't they? I mean, Ewan, am I being down on this? What do you make of it?
I'm just thinking about the rollout of Care Data, which is, you know, NHS's attempt to get us to share our medical records anonymized and de-identified. I could see people having concerns. What I'm worried about actually is oversharing, you know, because like you go to somebody's Facebook page and they've got baby pictures and all of this, and I really don't want to hear status updates about somebody's poo.
Yeah. But what is the best thing it's going to give me? Because I really, you know, I'll embrace this stuff with open arms and then moan when something goes wrong rather than the other way around. But what is the best thing that is going to happen for me?
Well, I mean, you know, for you, I don't know what's going on up there in Sample's mind, so I'm going to sidestep that one quite quickly. But for me, get back to me, I think there's a fantastic touchscreen fridge, which is sort of a prototype knocking around, which apparently analyzes the food that you have stuck inside your fridge and then suggests recipes. Fantastic. No more strange concoctions from leftover bits of asparagus. No. You can have a nice recipe churned out for you.
But that's the joy of serendipitous living. I mean, the whole idea that there's going to be some voice, some computer-coded voice that's going to be saying, well, there's nothing left in your fridge again. You're going to be on Shreddies. And, you know, unless you go and buy this, that, and the other, it's like, shut up.
Well, it won't only be your computer's voice, because a lot of these things are actually going to probably end up being voice-controlled. So it'll be your voice as well that's adding into that mix.
Awful.
Some people, you know, can see the benefits of it.
Is this dystopian nightmare going to happen in my lifetime?
Well, it's certainly chugging forwards. And David Cameron's a big fan of the idea. He's hailed it as a new industrial revolution, essentially.
He would know.
And huge amounts of investments are going on in this. In fact, for the firm CB Insights claimed recently that investors pumped about $667 million into the Internet of Things technology in 2013 alone. So it's obviously an area that's flourishing.
Thanks, Nicola. And also a big thanks to Ewan Calloway from Nature there. We'll have links to all the stories discussed on the blog for this podcast. Now, in our next edition of the podcast, we're going to ask one of the biggest questions faced by all England fans in the universe.
So I'm Professor Greg White. I'm a professor of applied sport and exercise science.
What do you reckon the chances are of getting out the groups?
Well, that's a tough... Honestly, it's going to be very, very tough.
Yes, we'll have all the facts about the challenges for the England team as they face Italy in their World Cup opener. A dominant idea in culture, in fact a common phrase, is the madness of crowds, the assumption that large groups are by default a shortcut to violence and irrational behaviour. But social scientists have, over the past decades, tended to prove that wrong, and this area of research is what forms the core of science writer Michael Bond's new book, The Power of Others, exploring the tension between our instinctive actions as an individual and the evolutionary drive towards groupthink. The Guardian's Pascal Wise met up with Michael to discuss how we navigate the power of others.
Michael, this might be a reflection of my particular reading habits, but this book joins a number of recent publications that, to put it cheekily, sort of imply that despite millions of years of evolution, we've basically no idea what we're doing. In fact, the opening line of the book says, "We may think we're running the show, but most of the time it's the other way round." So if we're not in charge of ourselves, who is?
I think we are in charge of ourselves. It's more a case of us not really knowing in the ways in which we are. And I mean, it always sounds very alarming, the idea that somehow we have this hidden nature that controls our lives. But the reason really I wrote the book was because I find it quite reassuring. I mean, we've evolved to be extremely good at socializing and in connecting with each other. And occasionally that leads us astray, but overall we'd be a lot worse off without these sort of social skills.
I mean, it's almost a cliche to say, yes, that we are, of course, social animals. But you've shown how the natures of that socializing and the effects it can have on us can really take us to, you know, real extremes.
It can. I mean, this is one of the problems with talking about human behavior in general is that the conversation often veers towards the extremes. And really in my book, I guess I'm looking at probably 40, 50 years of social psychology research.
Yeah.
And it's quite well established in academia that people are led as much by the situation they're in, particularly by the people they're with, more than their own personal dispositions and personalities.
Sure.
But I sort of felt that that wasn't really part of the public conversation, and somehow we live our lives in ignorance of these dynamics, and it can be useful. I mean, partly in order for us to be more aware of those extremes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you mentioned that idea of the public discourse on this, and I found it fascinating in the book to learn more about the psychology of mobs and crowds. I mean, mobs is a rather unfair term, but you speak a lot about how great demonstrating crowds of people, let's say if I sort of struggle for a relatively neutral term, are painted as really accessing our most base and even evil instincts, and that's clearly not the case. Science is finding otherwise.
Yes, I mean, this idea goes back to the French Revolution, really. If you're in a mob, then you somehow lose your sense of identity and individuality. But no, it really is not the case. And the inside story, if you like, comes from social psychologists, mainly a small group of British social psychologists, foremost among them probably Clifford Stott, now at the University of Leeds, who embedded himself in football crowds for 10 years. But what he found, and what other social psychologists have found, is that when you're in a crowd, it's not a case of you losing your identity so much as your sphere of interest ramping up from the individual to the group. So we take on a sort of a social identity, if you like, and become very strongly aware of those around us. I mean, a very good example would be if you're traveling into work on the train or on the underground, for example, and you're perhaps just sitting there minding your own business, reading the paper, looking at your phone, and suddenly the train comes to a juddering halt and you might smell a whiff of burning.
Yeah,
and very quickly you stop reading your paper and looking at your phone and start looking around you. And instead of avoiding eye contact, people tend to actually seek it out in those situations.
Yeah.
And suddenly you've got a psychological crowd, but it's not an irrational one.
Something that is a sort of a theme through the book is this idea of, you know, we often want people to be monsters as a reassurance for us. Because if you can paint somebody as a monster, then you are by definition different. You can sort of say, oh God, thank God I'm not like them. And when science starts to tell us that many of the people, as you say in the book, who perpetrate what we'd consider great evil are in fact rather more balanced than we think, that's quite an unsettling thought for us.
It is an unsettling thought, because, as you say, it would be easy if we could explain away evil or bad behavior or rampaging mobs on the bad apples or people who are inherently criminal in some way. But the majority of that kind of behavior cannot be explained away. I mean, if you look at people who have been involved, I mean, the front page of The Guardian today, for example, the story about the International Criminal Court investigating British soldiers in Iraq and some of the, whether they're committing war crimes or that sort of behavior is almost inevitably going to be unpredictable. The people who might have been involved, there's no way that you could look at them before they went there into that environment and predict that they were going to behave like that. I mean, through history, that's been shown. I think one of the problems with crowds is that if you're on the outside of a crowd looking in, it can look like a terrifying mass of people. But if you're on the inside, it's a completely different environment. And if you try and project your sort of understanding of what it looks like onto how people actually behave, then you make all kinds of mistakes. I mean, a great example, which is the psychologist Clifford Stott, who I talked about. One thing he's managed to change is the way police interact with crowds.
Sure.
Because if the police imagine that a crowd is full of potentially violent, roguish elements, then they're going to react in a fairly robust, possibly violent way towards them. But if there's some communication between the two groups, then it's a completely different scenario evolves.
Yeah, of course, yeah. This phrase, the banality of evil, which is slightly sort of misused, as you explain in the book, isn't it?
I think it is.
People take that to mean we all have a monster inside us, don't they?
Yes. I think the truth is more that behaviour is influenced very strongly by the situation we're in, particularly with the people we're with. But that doesn't mean to say that everybody is going to behave the same way in any given situation. And in fact, the flip side of acknowledging our sociality and that side of our behaviour is that behaviour is very unpredictable.
Yeah.
And that's one of the problems. I mean, but there are positive sides to that. If you look at war heroes, for example, and you analyze their lives and what happened before they did their courageous act that they won a medal for, very often they're not inherently courageous people. Their courageous act came out of nowhere. Well, actually, what it came out of was the environment that they're in. You know, they're surrounded by their colleagues who are suffering. And that sort of social environment is what inspires acts good and bad, but they're often unpredictable.
Well, it's a very nice positive corollary, really, in the book, because this idea that monsters, you know, we don't want to be felt able to be a monster, the nice flip side is that heroism can, you know, come from very ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances.
It can. There have been some fascinating studies on the people who helped Jewish families in occupied Europe during the Second World War. And a lot of people had the opportunity to hide Jews and didn't. But a few people did, at great risk to themselves. And there's been a few studies looking at trying to find out what it is about those people. Was that behavior predictable? Was there something about their personality? In most cases, very unpredictable. The one thing that the current that sort of runs through their lives seems to be more to do with their upbringing than their actual personality and any inherent traits they might possess. They seem to be brought up by parents who fed them a sort of idea of a universal morality. And it's interesting because it's very rare. I mean, when we talk about being social animals, we are social, but up to a point, we tend to veer towards our in-group.
I was going to come on to that, actually, this idea of, you know, we assume there's sociability going on, but actually just getting people together in the same, like multiculturalism, you know, it doesn't automatically work, does it? There has to be a sort of concerted interaction or sharing, perhaps.
This is one of the criticisms of a multicultural society where you have lots of different cultural groups living side by side. The problem with that is that if there's any kind of crisis or difficult economic situation where people's lives become difficult, then very quickly those separate groups look inward and prejudices among the groups increase.
Yeah.
It really only works if there is a deep bonding between the groups. And that means people have to be on the same school committees. They have to, have children at the same schools, but also interact day to day. And otherwise, things get difficult,
proximity is not enough.
Right. And in fact, in difficult times, it can exacerbate the situation because we very quickly adhere to that sort of affection for our in-group.
It's very interesting in the book how sentences given for violence or people involved with the riots were disproportionately harsh, because there's a sense that any sort of group activity is more, perhaps, I don't know, more criminal, I don't know, but
more dangerous.
Or more dangerous.
Those people who were involved in the London riots were judged afterwards. That's a very good example of how politics interferes with the legal system, because what really led to those and they were very harsh judgments. I mean, it was an average of four times the length of sentence that was given to those people who took part in the riots, four times compared to a similar crime that
on
was committed.
Just on a solo basis.
Beforehand. But that was partly because there was this political pressure to appear to be punishing those who were responsible. There's always a ruling in the legal system that those who are involved in crimes that where they're part of a group do get punished more severely, and there are some good reasons for that because they can cause a lot more damage and certainly instill a lot more fear. But in this case, it was really politicians who were coming out saying everyone involved was just criminals. It was criminality, pure and simple. I think David Cameron said it, and there was this sense that they were inherently bad even before they stepped into that riot. And so the sentences were particularly harsh. There was no scientific or social psychological justification for that at all. It was only a response to the political pressure, I think. Yeah. I mean, that's a very good example of how awareness of social psychology has not entered the sort of public conversation, certainly the political and the media.
Yeah, because perhaps there are certain resistances to progress being made in certain areas because it would loosen the grip, you know, this fear grip, perhaps potentially.
Yes, and also it allows politicians to sort of disown any kind of inherent problem that there might be that might be contributing to public disorder.
Yeah.
So if everybody's a criminal, then you don't have to deal with any legitimate cause.
Right.
So that's a dangerous line of thinking.
And as you say, the way to understand these things is to get right in amongst it, as a couple of people in the book who, potentially receive criticism from their academic peers because the nature of their research is pretty much, to go right into the heart of it. It sounds to me like you've done quite a lot of that too in your...
I have in an unscientific way. Yeah. I mean, I've really been looking at the research that these people have, social psychologists have been doing. I've been fascinated with crowds and have spent quite a lot of time in them. But the way you get the good science is from those researchers who have spent week after week embedding themselves with a tape recorder, with a notebook. And that sort of observational science is incredibly useful and has certainly had an effect on public order policing in Europe and the UK.
A huge thanks to Michael Bond there, and The Power of Others is published by One World and out in all good on and offline bookstores. That's all we have for you this week. From me, Ian Sample, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, thanks for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.